There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast bringing together the best bits of today's show from Sunday, January the 5th. How much of your privacy are you signing away when you use public Wi-Fi networks?
Like we didn't read the terms and conditions, and they betrayed us. Don't need permission to wake up, because silence is your consent for them to consistently rape us. Let's go.
Here is the back story. I was in a cafe stroke restaurant last week, went out to see a movie, had to do some prep for this show in the morning. Sat down, ordered myself a bit of dinner, went to log on. And the following popped up. I couldn't find a way to log on through my email. It seemed to me, at least, that the options were sort of using a social media network to get in. So I pushed Twitter. I chose Twitter out of the list of ways.
It says, do you want to log on using your Facebook, your Twitter, your email, or your footprint,
exactly,
whatever it may be?
Yeah. Exactly. Email may have been there. I'm not saying it wasn't, but whatever it was, I went for Twitter. Anyway, this is what popped up. It said, you know, the whole, you know, put your password in and all the rest of it. Fine. And then it said to me, this application will be able to see tweets from your timeline, including protected tweets, as well as your list and contacts. That's quite standard. I didn't have a problem with that. See your Twitter profile information and account settings. Again, we're kind of used to giving that away. That's all right. See the accounts you follow, mute and block. Yeah, all right. Follow and unfollow accounts for you. Hang on now. Update your profile and account settings. I'm sorry. Post and delete tweets for you and engage with tweets posted by others. Like, unlike, reply, retweet, etc. Create, manage and delete lists and collections for you. Mute, block and report accounts for you, which I had never seen anything like that before.
And it wasn't in small fine print, 8-point size at the bottom of a 3,000-word disclaimer. It was in bold infographic letters, wasn't it?
Yeah, which actually, by the way, I applaud the fact that it wasn't hidden, like you say, in the terms and conditions that we know statistically none of us read. So we got in touch. The restaurant was Common Ground in the Mall of the Emirates. So our producer, Mohammed, reached out to them, and fair play to Common Grounds. They got straight back. Taylor Kelly, the general manager, got back and said, look, I'm paraphrasing here, I'm a bit confused. I've never seen this before. So he went off to check with the IT manager and said the third party that runs our networks has been bought by a new company and they've changed policies. And then he said, there's a beta device there that's been running without the knowledge of myself or our IT manager. And he said, we're going to be removing that today. We're going to be putting in a purely independent device and make sure that we've got, you know, basically full control over our network. There will be no odd pop-ups. And then the IT manager got in touch with us shortly afterwards to say, look, we've just done that. We've replaced the third-party guest Wi-Fi in the Common Grounds restaurant. So it's now just free Wi-Fi. There are no logins, whatever, that are required, and it's fully open to the guests. Thank you for highlighting the concerns, et cetera, et cetera. So fair play to Common Grounds for taking action immediately.
That is pretty good, to
I think
be
within
fair.
About 24 hours. And apparently, I mean, I haven't been back in the last couple of days, but apparently it's just now open Wi-Fi, no logins. We tried to get hold of the network provider and the company that had bought them for a statement. So far, as I know it, we haven't.
Where are they based?
I think the company that's bought them is in America. So we're still reaching out for them and we will keep you updated. But the whole thing just got us thinking, right? I mean, you know, good on you to Common Grounds for realising there was an issue and going in and sorting it. But number one, what legally can people do with your social network profiles? Because that's what all of them want now. They don't really want your email to spam you as much. They want access to your socials. So what legally can they and can they not do with your socials? And also, what should you do? If you need to, like I did, I had sort of an hour and a half window before the movie started. I needed to do some work. In the end, I just tethered myself, funny enough, to the Wi-Fi that I pay for through my phone.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, slow and drains the battery of your phone like nothing else.
Yeah, but gets the job done.
But should we even be using, you know, Wi-Fi publicly? How how much is this the new frontier? How much of a concern is it? It used to be that you worried about people sniffing, you know, on the network and maybe stealing all of your bank details. And so, you know, I think for a long time we've all known that you don't sort of sit there and start transferring money around the place when you're on an open public Wi-Fi. But how much of a danger is this really? We've got some experts to tell us really whether we should be using these at all. And one of them is Shah Sheikh, senior cyber security consultant and the co-founder of DTS Solutions. And we asked him, why would a company even want my social media details?
Well, there's many facets to getting information about your social profile. So if you're on a public Wi-Fi and they ask you to log in through your Facebook account or your Twitter account, the primary reason is for them to start understanding who you are, who you're connected to, what kind of things you like, you dislike, and then they can then use that information for various marketing activities. So you may then receive marketing updates about certain products that you've been looking at to purchase, etc. So this is very much a game where data is the next big oil. And essentially, the data that you own and along with all your connections can be used for various monetary purposes by these social media platforms. One thing that I would like to say is that, you know, when you do use services for free, you do become the product. So essentially, this is basically what is happening right now.
So what's acceptable? We said to Shah, what is an acceptable level of giving up a bit of your data?
Every individual that do connect to public Wi-Fi or any kind of service that is for free, whether that's Facebook, Twitter, etc., you should always give the minimum level of personal information. And that's one of the reasons why in European Union, they established a mandatory law called GDPR. This basically ensures that all organizations have to only collect minimum amount of personal information and not information that is not required for them not to do the job. So very minimal information should be collected. And if more information is required, then there's absolute explicit consent that is taken from these individuals so that they know that exactly what is the reason why that information is being collected and for what reason they'll be using that as well.
And of course, the dangers of using public Wi-Fi isn't just the data you might be giving away to the legit operator of the network. It's also whether or not other people are pretending to be the legit network but are actually malevolent players. And so we said to Shah, what signs do we need to look out for to make sure that the network we're connecting to is bona fide?
Well, this is the tricky thing, because it's easy for me just to sit outside of, for example, Starbucks and set up a wireless access point and call it free Starbucks Wi-Fi and then get people to connect to it. So it's very easy to run a rogue Wi-Fi access point, is what we call an evil twin in the technical terms. And then once users are connected, then it's as easy as getting them to give us their username and passwords to then be able to log on to the internet. So it's very difficult to know exactly whether you're connected to the legitimate Wi-Fi access point or not. But essentially, there are telltale signs. You know, when you connect, you should usually get a captive portal to register. If you don't, then it probably is suspicious, and you should immediately disconnect and use other methods of connecting to the internet.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We're talking public Wi-Fi. After I actually stopped to read the small print for once whilst logging onto a cafe network and found that I was giving the Wi-Fi operator the right to change my Twitter profile and tweet on my behalf, amongst other things, which came as a bit of a shock. Now, the cafe where this occurred said that it didn't know that the third party who was looking after the Wi-Fi networks was running what they said was a beta device that was generating the pop-ups. And when we pointed it out, they immediately removed it. And they've now got an open Wi-Fi with no logins. So good on them for doing that. But it has left us questioning what people can legally do with the social media accounts that you log in with and with your personal data. We're very pleased to be joined in the studio by Martin Haywood, who is the head of technology, media and telecoms at the law firm Altamimi & Co. Martin, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We sent you through a copy of the T's and C's that I encountered. What did you make of them?
Well, we were quite surprised, because it's not the normal thing you see pop up when you're using public Wi-Fi. There's been a ton of news over the last couple of years, and the UAE Telecoms Regulatory Authority, the TRA, has been very proactive in getting information out to people in terms of using free public Wi-Fi and what to expect and what not to expect. But as you found when you visited the cafe, that was unusual. And I think you captured the point exactly, which is read the small print. I mean, we're always advising, where we're advising clients, you know, get terms of use around your public Wi-Fi and really set out and tell people what you're going to do and what you're not.
How legally binding is that small print? I mean, if they put in there, I have to give them a kidney, would I actually have to give them a kidney?
Hopefully not. I don't think so, no. I think that would be a little unreasonable. I mean, terms of use are pretty vanilla. They're pretty standard things that we see all around the world. I mean, fundamentally, what you can do with the information is subject to the consent of the individual. I think the individual needs to make a choice if they read the terms of use and they see things in there, such as removing kidneys. They're not agreeing to them.
Okay, so the removing kidney is probably a bit of hyperbole, but why is the small print there in the first place? I mean, what do operators actually want to do with my social media account?
Well, there's a lot of things. That information's valuable, and there's a lot of talk these days about what we call data monetization, which is basically taking your data and using it commercially. Now, when we get into the public Wi-Fi space, there's not that much information really that's of great commercial value. So there's certain things that public Wi-Fi operators need to collect from a regulatory point of view, that they need to provide to the competent authorities. Beyond that, they need the consent of the individuals to use any more of that information in any other way.
But is it legal that if I'd have ticked yes on this, would the Wi-Fi operator have been able to tweet from my account if I agreed to it? Would that have been fine?
No, I don't think so. And I think that's something that would be well beyond what we would normally see from those kind of terms of use, just literally logging on to public Wi-Fi. That's the kind of stuff we would see, for example, if you are connecting into third-party apps that would work off of your Twitter account. And those terms of use would need to be pretty comprehensive in terms of exactly what they're going to do and what they're not. So you're fully informed in making that decision.
Researchers have called the bit where we click, where we say, yes, I've read and understand this, the biggest lie on the internet, because no one ever, ever does. What's the solution to that?
It's a difficult one. There was a fantastic statistic out once recently that said for one of the social media sites, it would take a number of days to read and really understand the terms of use that you sign up to. For that reason, the best way that it can be done is that the terms of use are as clear and simple as possible, and they set out very clearly. And that's what the TRA is saying. It really drives business to make sure that they're very clear in terms of the guidelines that they set out in terms of how that information can be used.
Should I be nervous about them, though? Should I be worried about what I'm actually signing?
I think where you're logging on to something where there aren't terms of use, I'd be concerned. And I mean, that then goes to, okay, what exactly are you doing over that? And that's the key point, is when you're using public Wi-Fi, what are you doing with it? I mean, you know, normal thing is don't do your online banking. You know, if you don't want people to know what websites you're visiting, don't use public Wi-Fi. But beyond that, I think that, you know, at the end of the day, is we live in a connected society. We want connectivity on the move wherever we are. We want to be able to have Wi-Fi available, and it's something of a trade-off as a result.
So other than sort of not using the public Wi-Fi, are there any red flags? Are there any sort of watchwords that people should look for in the T's and C's?
I think it goes back to the point, if the T's and C's are long, if they're confusing, if you can't see very quickly what people are going to do with your information. And really, on public Wi-Fi, it should very much be, we are collecting maybe an email address. That's it for that would be required for the authorities. Then, you know, I challenge that, and I'd want to know really what the purpose is they're going to make do with the data.
Final question: is it better to sign in through a social? Because you often get the option, don't you? Better to sign in through a social media account or by giving your email?
It's an interesting question. I personally always use the form. There's no particular reason for that. I mean, I think that, once again, if you sign in through Facebook or you sign in through Twitter or Instagram or something like that, you got to check what those terms of use are, because you've got a lot more information. If I sign a form, all I'm giving is my email address, maybe a mobile phone number.
You're just going to get spammed.
Exactly. And there's laws against that. If I'm signing up to Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, then I'm making potentially making a lot more information available. Once again, I'm checking the terms of use, because if someone's going to start using that information, I want to know what they're doing with it.
Martin Hayward, Head of Technology, Media and Telecoms at the law firm El Tamimi & Co. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We are going to hear a familiar voice to many of you, that of Jessica Swan. She's a former Dubai Eye and ABC journalist, currently National Secretariat with the Australian Arab Chamber of Commerce and Industry. She also teaches at Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne. Speaking to you under obviously the most awful of circumstances this morning, to get an update on what's happening with the fires in Australia, to try and take some sense of the human, the ecological and the economic impact of them. Now, you're in Mount Eliza on the Mornington Peninsula, aren't you? Explain to us why that's significant.
So the Mornington Peninsula is an area which is just across the bay, what's called the Western Port Bay, where the area of major mass evacuations have been taking place for the last 24 hours. So in an area called Mallacoota, which is the Gippsland region, which many people around the world have seen some of the most horrific images that are coming out of this part of Australia. So over the last 24 hours, we've seen 1,000 people and their animals and their pets being evacuated from those beach areas. Now, there is no way that anybody can get in and out of those regions at the moment, Brandy. So it's only air and sea. So the people that have been evacuated to the Mornington Peninsula, which is where I am, which is where it's very safe, they've come here by army vessels, so Navy vessels. So two Navy vessels have brought 1,000 people here over the last 24 hours.
And what kind of welcome are they getting, Jess? What's being done for them?
Well, for those people who do have family in Melbourne, there's all kinds of emergency services that are trying to... I mean, the ultimate thing is you want to get back to your family. So that's really the priority. So for those people who do have family and they do have the capacity to get there, then all of those services are being offered. There is a naval base in an area called Hastings. It's very close to where these people are being evacuated. And that's all been set up as an emergency service centre for them. So there's all kinds of services that are available for all of those people, everything from medical, financial support, or everything that you need in an emergency situation, down to the littlest things like hygiene packs and all kinds of things. Yesterday, the Prime Minister also announced that HMAS Adelaide, which is a very big naval ship, that was deployed from Sydney. Now, that has 400 personnel on it, and that's carrying 300 tonnes of relief supplies. And it also has a hospital on board. So that also gives you an understanding of the scale of these fires and the scale of the devastation and the damage. So that ship is also being deployed to various areas across the country. So, Brandy, just to give you an understanding and the listeners an understanding of what we're talking about in terms of scale. So far, 12 million acres have burned. That's around 5 million hectares. Now, when we're talking mass evacuations, 350 kilometres, which is roughly 217 miles on the south coast of New South Wales, have all been evacuated. Here in Victoria, we're having similar evacuations here in the size of roughly the size of Belgium. So this should give you a good understanding as to the situation that we're dealing with. Now, 2 days ago, we also had a state of disaster that was declared by our Premier in Victoria, Premier Daniel Andrews. And now this was declared, as well as the New South Wales Premier declaring a state of emergency there. So the reason why they've declared these states of disaster and emergency are because of the unpredictable nature of these fires. Now, they're so severe that they're exceeding human and computer predictions. So there is it's very difficult to predict what's happening with these fires at the moment. And they're creating their own weather patterns. So pyrocumulonimbus clouds and weather patterns are creating a very dangerous kind of storm coverage as well. And that storm coverage creates lightning, which of course creates more fires.
Yeah,
so that's the situation that we're in at the moment.
What's it actually like? I mean, I'm looking at the latest update from the fire service in New South Wales, 148 fires, 60 not contained. What's it actually like for people living in this, Jess, not just the people being evacuated, but for Australians in the even in the bigger cities?
This is unprecedented, Brandy. So all of us are in the same state of shock. And the Prime Minister was speaking this morning in a press conference, and he was talking about the mental health effects of something of this scale. We've never seen anything like this in Australia. And the reason for this is, of course, we've had fires before. That's a given. We've had very big fires. Black Saturday was a very big fire we've dealt with a few years ago. But the reason why this is so significant, Brandy, is because we've had terrible, terrible drought for many, many, many months. And it's the combination of multiple environmental factors combined with some other decisions that were made over the last couple of years in terms of reducing our emergency services capacity. So there's multiple factors that it has ever seen before. So you can understand that everybody's in a state of shock. Everybody wants to help. You've got people right across the country. There's little kids in the area that I live. They're selling everything from cupcakes. They're making lemonade. You're driving through the streets and people are just selling things to raise money to try and get that money to those people who are most in need. So it's having an effect on all of us. Everybody's in shock and everybody's looking to, well, what are the solutions? And there's a lot of very, very interesting conversations going on at the moment. Do we look to our Indigenous elders? Do we look to the original custodians of this landscape to find out from them? They lived on this land for 60,000 years. So what is it that we can learn from them that perhaps we need to be listening and we haven't listened to in the past? So there's a lot of those very interesting conversations going on around how can we manage our environment better in a way that we've never done so before.
Look, Jess, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. Jessica Swan, former Dubai Eye and ABC journalist, currently National Secretariat with the Australian Arab Chamber of Commerce and Industry, speaking to us from Mount Eliza on the Mornington Peninsula.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The people making the headlines today.
Starting with Carlos Ghosn and Elon Musk. Who goes first, Brandy Scott?
Carlos Ghosn's already gone, so let's go with him.
Some light has been shed, a little bit at least, on his escape from Tokyo. And you're a little bit disappointed because it may not be as cloak and dagger as we first suspected.
Yeah, look, we're still in the position, as pretty much every commentator is saying, that there are still more questions than there are answers. But there are some little bits of answers. So not so much shedding a light as a murky head torch, if you like. Here's the thing. The bit that I'm disappointed, possibly wrongly, about is it doesn't seem like there was a double base case used at all.
Ouch.
Gutted. Japanese public broadcaster NHK TV has cited people involved in the investigation as saying that there is security footage that show I'm just walking out the house.
Oh, that's not nearly as exciting.
No, around lunchtime and then never came back. I don't know enough about the ins and outs of security footage and how often it was viewed and all the rest of it. That seems quite amazing, but there you go. What we do have is we have an arrest criminal complaint filed in Turkey by the private jet operator that leased two planes to Carlos Ghosn, MNG Jet. The CEO has come out and said that one of their members of staff has admitted to falsifying passenger records, but doing so, you know, on his own individual capacity rather than with the company's knowledge. And Japanese prosecutors have apparently raided the house that Carlos Ghosn was in Tokyo. Interpol has issued a wanted notice for him, but there is, of course, no extradition treaty, as we were reporting last week, between Japan and Lebanon. And Carlos Ghosn himself has come out and made a second statement, because, of course, there was that first famous now statement saying that he wasn't fleeing justice, but rather that he was escaping injustice. Carlos Ghosn, if you are just joining this story, the 65-year-old former boss of Nissan Renault, who was under house arrest in Japan, awaiting trial for charges of financial misconduct in which he could have faced a 15-year prison sentence. He has come out and said now, and we're still waiting for the sort of the stand-up that he's going to do, the press conference, as it were, but he's come out and said that anything in the media saying that his wife, Carol, and other members of the family played any role whatsoever in his departure from Japan, and it's interesting as well that he says departure. He says they're false and misleading. He alone organised his departure. The alone bit, that's a lot of organisation for a man under house arrest.
Delegation. Have a listen to this. This is Bob Lutz. He's the former vice chairman of General Motors, talking to the guys at CNBC. His take on Carlos Ghosn, and it's a less than charitable view of the former Nissan boss.
We don't know. You know, he claims he's the victim of a conspiracy to oust him. But having known Carlos Ghosn for a number of years and having observed his personality over the decades and seeing him become more and more imperious and clearly suffering from CEO disease, where he showed all the signs of believing himself to be omnipotent and infallible.
CEO disease.
I'm going to be adding that to the list of new words that I secretly keep on my laptop. Did you know that I do that, by the way?
I did not.
I have a list of new words that I secretly keep on my laptop. This weekend's new word that got added, by the way, was yold.
Which means?
Young old.
Oh dear.
Sprightly baby boomers who are leaping around the planet on holidays because 60 is the new 50 is the new 40. You're not old, you're yold.
My newsmaker this morning is His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, who is, of course, the Vice President and Prime Minister of the UAE, but this time in his capacity as ruler of Dubai. It's the 15th anniversary, or yesterday was, of his accession to the position of ruler of Dubai. And he's issued what he's calling his 2020 charter in a letter. Now, there are multiple elements to this, but I've picked up on a couple of them. First up, the Dubai Council. It's a new organisation. He's going to chair it, and it's going to oversee what he says is the vision for the Emirates' next 50 years. Short term as well, implementing that vision. He's broken it down into six different pillars of Dubai, not just the Dubai economy, but six different pillars of Dubai, strategic pillars, he calls them. Global competitiveness, economic leadership, attractiveness, those kind of things. And most of it, to be honest, is fairly standard stuff that you might expect from a visionary leader in a visionary government like Dubai. We've seen it before. Fine. The one that grabbed me is Article 12 of his letter, where he says the following: those who fail to bring about real change within the 2 years shall be relieved of their duties. And that is very much a stick as well as a carrot to the senior officials charged with implementing this kind of strategy. I mean, I know it's perhaps not an entirely radical departure from policy here. We've seen His Highness Sheikh Mohammed with his early morning visits to various government departments, dismissing people after that because they weren't at their desks earlier on. But it just struck me that this was a very clear message that we mean business. This is not just about having a strategy. It's not just about having a vision. It is about implementation. It is about real change. And if that change doesn't happen, then there will be consequences, particularly for the senior members of government. Sheikh Mohammed is my newsmaker this morning. Other stories that we're covering today: Kareem and Uber. The deal is done, $3.1 billion. Kareem has taken over Uber, although they insist that they will remain separate companies and separate brands competing with one another. Madassah Shaker, one of the founders of Kareem, remains the CEO of Kareem.
Thanks for listening. Rich and I will be back on air tomorrow morning from 6.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.